think that's all I've got to ask about that afternoon, said Strike. But you might be able to help me with something else. Do you know Tansy Bestigwi?
No,
said Bryony. Only her sister, Ursula. She's hired me a couple of times for big parties. She's awful. In what way? Just one of those spoiled rich women. Well, said Bryony with a twist to her mouth, she isn't nearly as rich as she'd like to be. Both those Chillingham sisters went for old men with bags of money. Wealth-seeking missiles, the pair of them. Ursula thought she'd hit the jackpot when she married Cyprian May, but he hasn't got nearly enough for her. She's knocking 40 now. The opportunities aren't there the way they used to be. I suppose that's why she hasn't been able to trade up. Then, evidently feeling that her tone needed some explanation, she continued, I'm sorry, but she accused me of listening to her bloody voicemail messages. The makeup artist folded her arms across her chest, glaring at Strike. I mean police. She chucked me her mobile and told me to call her a cab, without so much as a bloody please or thank you. I'm dyslexic. I hit the wrong button and the next thing I know, she's screaming her bloody head off at me.
Why do you think she was so upset?
Because I heard a man she wasn't married to telling her he was lying in a hotel room fantasizing about going down on her, I expect, said Bryony coolly.
So she might be trading up after all, asked Strike.
That's not up, said Bryony. But then she added hastily, I mean pretty tacky message. Anyway, listen, I've got to get back out there, or Guy will be going ballistic. He let her go. After she had left, he made two more pages of notes. Bryony Radford had shown herself a highly unreliable witness, suggestible and mendacious, but she had told him much more than she knew. Chapter 7. The shoot lasted for another 3 hours. Strike waited in the garden, smoking and consuming more bottled water, while dusk fell. From time to time he wandered back into the building to check on progress, which seemed immensely slow. Occasionally he glimpsed or heard Sommet, whose temper seemed frayed, barking instructions at the photographer or one of the black-clad minions who flitted between clothes racks. Finally, at nearly 9 o'clock, after Strike had consumed a few slices of the pizza that had been ordered by the morose and exhausted stylist's assistant, Chiara Porter descended the stairs where she had been posing with her two colleagues, and joined Strike in the makeup room, which Bryony was busy stripping bare. Chiara was still wearing the stiff silver mini-dress in which she had posed for the last picture. Attenuated and angular, with milk-white skin, hair almost as fair, and pale blue eyes set very wide apart, she stretched out her endless legs in platform shoes that were tied with long silver threads up her calves, and lit a Marlboro light.
"God, I can't believe you're Roker's son," she said breathlessly, her chrysoberyl eyes and full lips both wide. "Just beyond weird. I know him. He invited Luli and me to the greatest hits launch last year. And I know your brothers, Al and Eddie. They told me they had a big brother in the army. God, mad. Is that you done, Bryony?"
Chiara added pointedly. The makeup artist seemed to be making a laborious business of gathering up the tools of her trade. Now she sped up perceptibly, while Chiara smoked and watched her in silence.
"Yep, that's me," said Bryony brightly at last, hoisting a heavy box over her shoulder and picking up more cases in each hand. "See you, Chiara. Goodbye," she added to Strike, and left.
"She is so bloody nosy and such a gossip," Chiara told Strike. She threw back her long white hair, rearranged her coltish legs, and asked,
"Do you see a lot of Al and Eddie?"
"No," said Strike.
"And your mum?"
she said, unfazed, blowing smoke out of the corner of her mouth. "I mean, she's just like a legend. You know how Baz Carmichael did a whole collection 2 seasons back called Super Groupie, and it was like B.B. Buell and your mum were the whole inspiration. Maxi skirts and buttonless shirts and boots."
"I didn't," said Strike.
Oh, it was like, you know that great quote about Ozzie Clark dresses, how men liked them because they could just, like, open them up really easily and fuck the girls. That's like your mum's whole era.
She shook her hair out of her eyes again and gazed at him, not with a chilling and offensive appraisal of Tansy Bestigui, but in what seemed to be frank and open wonder. It was difficult for him to decide whether she was sincere or performing her own character. Her beauty got in the way, like a thick cobweb through which it was difficult to see her clearly.
"So, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you about Lula."
"God, yeah. Yeah, no, I really want to help. When I heard someone was investigating it, I was like, well, good, at last."
"Really?"
"God, yeah. The whole thing was so fucking shocking. I just couldn't believe it. She's still on my phone. Look at this."
She rummaged in an enormous handbag, finally retrieving a white iPhone. Scrolling down the contact list, she leaned into him, showing him the name Luli. Her perfume was sweet and peppery.
"I keep expecting her to call me," said Kiara, momentarily subdued, slipping the phone back into her bag. "I can't delete her. I keep going to do it and then just, like, bottling it, you know?"
She raised herself restlessly, twisted one of the long legs underneath her, sat back down, and smoked in silence for a few seconds.
"You were with her most of her last day, weren't you?" Strike asked.
"Don't fucking remind me," said Kiara, closing her eyes. "I've only been over it, like, a million times. Trying to get my head around how you can go from, like, completely bloody happy to dead in, like, hours."
"She was completely happy."
"God, happier than I'd ever seen her that last week. We got back from a job in Antigua for Vogue, and she and Evan got back together, and they had the commitment ceremony. It was all fantastic for her. She was on cloud nine."
"You were at this commitment ceremony?"
"Oh, yeah," said Kiara,
dropping her cigarette end into a can of Coke, where it was extinguished with a small hiss.
"God, it was beyond romantic. Evan just, like, sprang it on her at Dickie Carberry's house. You know Dickie Carberry, the restaurateur? He's got this fabulous place in the Cotswolds, and we were all there for the weekend. And Evan had bought them both matching bangles from Fergus Keane, gorgeous, oxidized silver. He forced us all down to the lake after dinner in the freezing cold and the snow, and then he recited this poem he'd written to her, and put the bangle on her wrist."
Luli was laughing her head off, but then she just, like, recited a poem she knew back to him.
"Walt Whitman, it was," said Kiara, with an air of sudden seriousness. "Honestly, like, so impressive. Just to have the perfect poem to say, just like that. People think models are dumb, you know."
She threw her hair back again and offered Strike a cigarette before taking another herself.
"I get so bored of telling people I've got a deferred place to read English at Cambridge."
"Have you?" asked Strike, unable to suppress the surprise in his voice.
"Yeah,"
she said, blowing out smoke prettily.
"But, you know, the modelling's going so well, I'm going to give it another year. It's opening doors, you know?"
"So this commitment ceremony was when? A week before Lula died?"
"Yeah," said Kiara. "The Saturday before."
"And it was just an exchange of poems and bangles? No vows? No officiant?"
"No, it wasn't legally binding or anything. It was just like this lovely, this perfect moment."
"Well, except for Freddie Bestigui, he was being a bit of a pain. But at least..." Kiara drew hard on her cigarette. "His bloody wife wasn't there."
"Tansy?"
"Tansy Chillingham, yeah. She's a bitch. It's so not a surprise they're divorcing. They led, like, totally separate lives. You never saw them out together. To tell you the truth, Freddie wasn't too bad that weekend, seeing what a nasty rep he's got. He was just a bore, the way he kept trying to suck up to Luli. But he wasn't awful, like they say he can be. I heard a story about this, like, totally naive girl he promised a bit part in a film. But I don't know whether it was true."
Kiara squinted for a moment at the end of her cigarette. She never reported it anyway. You said Freddy was being a pain. In what way?
Oh, God, he kept, like, cornering Luli and going on about how great she'd be on screen and, like, what a great bloke her dad was.
Sir Alec?
Yeah, Sir Alec, of course. Oh, my God, said Kiara wide-eyed. If he'd known her real father, Luli would have, like, flipped out completely. That would have been, like, the dream of her life. No, he just said he'd known Sir Alec years and years ago, and they came from, like, the same East End manor or something. So he should be considered, like, her godfather or something. I think he was trying to be funny, but not. Anyway, everyone could tell he was just trying to work out how to get her into a film. He was a jerk about the commitment ceremony. He kept shouting, "I'll give away the bride!" He was pissed. He drank like crazy all through dinner. Dickie had to shut him up. Then, after the ceremony, we all had champagne back at the house, and Freddie had, like, another 2 bottles on top of everything he'd already put away. He kept yelling at Luli that she'd make such a great actress, but she didn't care, she just ignored him. She was cuddled up with Evan on the sofa, just, like... And suddenly, tears were sparkling in Kiara's cold eyes, and she squashed them out of sight with the flat palms of her pretty white hands. Crazy in love. She was so fucking happy. I'd never seen her happier.
You met Freddy Bastigui again, didn't you? On the evening before Lula died. Didn't the two of you pass him in the lobby on your way out?
Yeah,
said Kiara, still dabbing at her eyes.
How did you know that?
Wilson, the security guard. He thought Bastigui said something to Lula that she didn't like.
Yeah, he's right. I'd forgotten about that. Freddy said something about D.B. Mack, about Luli being excited about him coming, how he really wanted to get them on film together. I can't remember exactly what it was, but he made it sound dirty, you know?
Did Lula know that Bastigui and her adoptive father had been friends?
She told me it was the first she'd ever heard of it. She always stayed out of Freddy's way at the flats. She didn't like Tansy.
Why not?
Oh, Luli wasn't interested in that whole, like, whose husband's got the biggest fucking yacht crap. She didn't want to get into their crowd. She was so much better than that. So not like the Chillingham girls.
Okay, said Strike. Can you talk me through the afternoon and evening you were with her? Kiara dropped her second fag end into the Coke can, with another little spitting fizz, and immediately lit another.
Yeah, okay, let me think. Well, I met her at her place in the afternoon. Bryony came over to do her eyebrows and ended up giving us both manicures. We just had, like, a girly afternoon together.
How did she seem?
She was...
Kiara hesitated.
Well, she wasn't quite as happy as she'd been that week. But not suicidal, I mean, no way.
Her driver, Kieran, thought she seemed strange when she left her mother's house in Chelsea.
Oh, God, yeah, well, why wouldn't she be? Her mum had cancer, didn't she?
Did Lula discuss her mother when she saw you?
No, not really. I mean, she said she'd just been sitting with her, because she was a bit, you know, pulled down after her op. But nobody thought then that Lady Bristow was going to die. The op was supposed to cure her, wasn't it?
Did Lula mention any other reason that she was feeling less happy than she had been?
No, said Kiara, slowly shaking her head, the white blonde hair tumbling around her face. She raked it back again and took a deep drag on her cigarette. She did seem a bit down, a bit distracted, but I just put it down to having seen her mum. They had a weird relationship. Lady Bristow was, like, really overprotective and possessive. Luli found it, you know, a bit claustrophobic.
Did you notice Lula telephoning anyone while she was with you?
No, said Kiara, after a thoughtful pause. I remember her checking her phone a lot, but she didn't speak to anyone, as far as I can remember. If she was phoning anyone, she was doing it on the quiet. She was in and out of the room a bit. I don't know.
Bryony thought she seemed excited about D.B. Mack.
Oh, for God's sake, said Kiara impatiently. It was everyone else who was excited about D.B. Mack. Guy and Bryony and, Well, even I was a bit, she said, with endearing honesty. But Luli wasn't that fast. She was in love with Evan. You can't believe everything Bryony says.
Did Lula have a piece of paper with her, that you can remember, a bit of blue paper which she'd written on?
No, said Kiara again. Why, what was it?
I don't know yet, said Strike, and Kiara looked suddenly thunderstruck.
God, you're not telling me she left a note?
Oh, my God! How fucking mad would that be?
But no, that would mean she'd have, like, already decided she was going to do it.
Maybe it was something else, said Strike. You mentioned at the inquest that Lula expressed an intention to leave everything to her brother, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right, said Kiara, earnestly nodding. Yeah, what happened was Guy had sent Luli these fabby handbags from the new range. I knew he wouldn't have sent me any, even though I was in the advert too. Anyway, I unwrapped the white one, Cashiel, you know, and it was just, like, beautiful. He does these detachable silk linings, and he'd had it custom printed for her with this amazing African print. So I said, Luli, will you leave me this one? Just as a joke. And she said, like, really seriously, I'm leaving everything to my brother, but I'm sure he'd let you have anything you want.
Strike was watching and listening for any sign that she was lying or exaggerating, but the words came easily and, to all appearances, frankly.
That was a strange thing to say, wasn't it? He asked.
Yes, I suppose, said Kiara, shaking the hair back off her face again. But Luli was like that. She could go a bit dark and dramatic sometimes. Guy used to say, less of the cuckoo, cuckoo. Anyway, Kiara sighed. She didn't take the hint about the Cashiel bag. I was hoping she'd just give it to me. I mean, she had four.
Would you say you were close to Lula?
Oh, God, yeah, super close. She told me everything.
A couple of people have mentioned that she didn't trust too easily, that she was scared of confidences turning up in the press. I've been told that she tested people to see whether she could trust them.
Oh, yeah. She did get a bit, like, paranoid after her real mum started selling stories about her. She actually asked me, said Kiara, with an airy wave of her cigarette, whether I told anyone she was back with Evan. I mean, come on! There was no way she was going to keep that quiet. Everyone was talking about it. I said to her, Luli, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. That's Oscar Wilde, she added kindly. But Luli didn't like that side of being famous.
Guy Sommet thinks that Lula wouldn't have got back with Duffield if he hadn't been out of the country.
Kiara glanced towards the door and dropped her voice. Guy would say that. He was just, like, super protective of Luli. He adored her. He really loved her. He thought Evan was bad for her. But honestly, he doesn't know the real Evan. Evan's, like, totally fucked up, but he's a good person. He went to see Lady Bristow not long ago, and I said to him, "Why, Evan? What on earth did you put yourself through that for?" Because, you know, her family hated him. And you know what he said? "I just want to speak to somebody who cares as much as I do that she's gone." I mean, how sad is that?
Strike cleared his throat.
"The press have totally got it in for Evan. It's just so unfair. He can't do anything right."
"Duffield came to your place, didn't he, the night she died?"
"God, yeah, and there you are," said Kiara indignantly. "They made out we were, like, shagging or something. He had no money and his driver had disappeared, so he just, like, hiked across London so he could crash at mine. He slept on the sofa. So we were together when we heard the news."
She raised her cigarette to her full mouth and drew deeply on it, her eyes on the floor.
"It was terrible. You can't imagine. Terrible. Evan was, oh my God. And then," she said, in a voice barely louder than a whisper, "they were all saying it was him. After Tansy Chillingham said she'd heard a row. The press just went crazy. It was awful."
She looked up at Strike, holding her hair off her face. The harsh overhead light merely illuminated her perfect bone structure.
You haven't met Evan, have you?
No.
Do you want to? You could come with me now. He said he was going along to Uzi tonight.
That'd be great.
Fabby, hang on.
She jumped up and called through the open door. Gee, sweetie, can I wear this tonight? Go on, to Uzi.
Samay entered the small room. He looked exhausted behind his glasses.
All right. Make sure you're photographed. Wreck it and I'll sue your skinny white ass.
I'm not going to wreck it. I'm taking Cormoran to meet Evan.
She stuffed her cigarettes away into her enormous bag, which appeared to hold her day clothes too, and hoisted it over her shoulder. In her heels, she was within an inch of the detective's height. Samay looked up at Strike. His eyes narrowed.
Make sure you give the little shit a hard time.
Gee, said Kiara, pouting. Don't be horrible.
And watch yourself, Master Rokeby, Samay added, with his usual edge of spite. Kiara's a terrible slut, aren't you, dear?
And she's like me. She likes them big.
Gee, said Kiara, in mock horror.
Come on, Cormoran. I've got a driver outside.
Chapter 8 Strike, forewarned, was nowhere near as surprised to see Kieran Colovis-Jones as the driver was to see him. Colovis-Jones was holding open the left-hand passenger door, faintly lit by the car's interior light, but Strike spotted his momentary change of expression when he laid eyes on Kiara's companion.
"Evening," said Strike,
moving around the car to open his own door and get in beside Kiara.
"Kieran, you've met Cormoran, haven't you?"
said Kiara, buckling herself in. Her dress had ridden up to the very top of her long legs. Strike could not be absolutely certain that she was wearing anything beneath it. She had certainly been braless in the white jumpsuit.
"Hi, Kieran," said Strike.
The driver nodded at Strike in the rearview mirror, but did not speak. He had assumed a strictly professional demeanour that Strike doubted was habitual in the absence of detectives. The car pulled away from the curb. Kiara started rummaging again in her bag. She removed a perfume spray and squirted herself liberally in a wide circle around her face and shoulders. Then dabbed lip gloss over her lips, talking all the while.
"What am I going to need? Money. Cormoran, would you be a total darling and keep this in your pocket? I'm not going to take this massive thing in."
She handed him a crumpled wad of twenties.
"You're a sweetheart. Oh, and I'll need my phone. Have you got a pocket for my phone? God, this bag's a mess."
She dropped it on the car floor.
"When you said that it would have been the dream of Lula's life to find her real father."
"Oh, God, it would have been. She used to talk about that all the time. She got really excited when that bitch, her birth mother, told her he was African. Guy always said that was bullshit, but he hated the woman."
"He met Marlene Higson, did he?"
"Oh, no. He just hated the whole, like, idea of her. He could see how excited Luli got, and he just wanted to protect her from being disappointed."
So much protection, Strike thought, as the car turned a corner in the dark. Had Lula been that fragile? The back of Colovis Jones's head was rigid, correct, his eyes flickering more often than was necessary to rest upon Strike's face. And then Luli thought she had a lead on him, her real father, but that went completely cold on her, dead end. Yeah, it was so sad. She really thought she'd found him, and then it all just fell through her fingers.
What lead was this?
It was something about where the college was, something her mother said. Luli thought she'd found the place it must have been, and she went to look at the records or something with this funny friend of hers called...
"Rochelle?" suggested Strike.
The Mercedes was now purring up Oxford Street.
"Yeah, Rochelle, that's right. Luli met her in rehab or something, poor little thing. Luli was, like, unbelievably sweet to her. Used to take her shopping and stuff. Anyway, they never found him, or it was the wrong place or something, I can't remember."
"Was she looking for a man called Aguiman?"
"I don't think she ever told me the name."
"Or Owusu?"
Kiara turned her beautiful light eyes upon him in astonishment.
That Guy's real name?
I know.
Oh, my God!
Kiara giggled.
Guy's dad never went to college. He was a bus driver. He used to beat Guy up for sketching dresses all the time. That's why Guy changed his name.
The car was slowing down. The long queue, four people wide, stretching along the block, led to a discreet entrance that might have been to a private house. A gaggle of dark figures was gathered around a white pillared doorway.
"Paps," said Colovis Jones, speaking for the first time.
"Careful how you get out of the car, Kiara."
He slid out of the driver's seat and walked around to the left-hand back door. But the paparazzi were already running, ominous, darkly clad men raising their long-nosed cameras as they closed in. Kiara and Strike emerged into flashes like gunfire. Strike's retinas were in sudden, dazzling whiteout. He ducked his head. His hand closed instinctively around Kiara Porter's slender upper arm, and he steered her ahead of him through the black oblong that represented sanctuary as the doors opened magically to admit them. The queuing hordes were shouting, protesting at their easy entry, yelping with excitement. And then the flashes stopped, and they were inside, where there was an industrial roar of noises and a loud, insistent bass line.
"Wow! You've got a great sense of direction," said Kiara. "I usually, like, ricochet off the bouncers, and they have to push me in."
Streaks and blazes of purple and yellow light were still burned across Strike's field of vision. He dropped her arm. She was so pale that she looked almost luminous in the gloom. Then they were jostled further inside the club by the entry of another dozen people behind them.
"Come on,"
said Kiara, and she slipped a soft, long-fingered hand inside his and tugged him along behind her. Faces turned as they walked through the packed crowd, both of them taller by far than the majority of clubbers. Strike could see what looked like long glass fish tanks set into the walls, containing what seemed to be great floating blobs of wax, reminding him of his mother's old lava lamps. There were long black leather banquettes along the walls, and further in, nearer the dance floor, booths. It was hard to tell how big the club was, because of judiciously placed mirrors. At one point, Strike caught a glimpse of himself head-on, looking like a sharply dressed heavy behind the silvery sylph that was Kiara. The music pounded through every part of him, vibrating through his head and body. The crowd on the dance floor was so dense that it seemed miraculous that they were managing even to stamp and sway. They had reached a padded doorway, guarded by a bald bouncer who grinned at Kiara, revealing two gold teeth, and pushed open the concealed entrance. They entered a quieter, though hardly less crowded bar area that was evidently reserved for the famous and their friends. Strike noticed a miniskirted television presenter, a soap actor, a comedian primarily famous for his sexual appetite, and then, in a distant corner, Evan Duffield. He was wearing a skull-patterned scarf wound around his neck and skin-tight black jeans, sitting at the join of two black leather banquettes, with arms stretched at right angles along the backs of the benches on either side, where his companions, mostly women, were crammed. His dark shoulder-length hair had been dyed blonde. He was pallid and bony-faced, and the smudges around his bright turquoise eyes were dark purple. The group containing Duffield was emanating an almost magnetic force over the room. Strike saw it in the sneaking sidelong glances other occupants were shooting them, in the respectful space left around them, a wider orbit than anybody else had been granted. Duffield and his cohort's apparent unself-consciousness was, Strike recognized, nothing but expert artifice. They had, all of them, the hyper-alertness of the prey animal combined with the casual arrogance of predators. In the inverted food chain of fame, it was the big beasts who were stalked and hunted. They were receiving their due. Duffield was talking to a sexy brunette. Her lips were parted as she listened, almost ludicrously immersed in him. As Kiara and Strike drew nearer, Strike saw Duffield glance away from the brunette for a fraction of a second, making, Strike thought, a lightning-fast recce of the bar, taking the measure of the room's attention and of other possibilities it might offer.
"Kiara!"
he yelled hoarsely. The brunette looked deflated as Duffield jumped nimbly to his feet. Thin and yet well-muscled, he slid out from behind the table to embrace Kiara, who was 8 inches taller than he in her platform shoes. She dropped Strike's hand to return the hug. The whole bar seemed, for a few shining moments, to be watching. Then they remembered themselves and returned to their chat and their cocktails.
"Evan, this is Cormoran Strike," said Kiara.
She moved her mouth close to Duffield's ear, and Strike saw, rather than heard her say,
"He's Johnny Rokeby's son." "All right, mate?"
asked Duffield, holding out a hand, which Strike shook. Like other inveterate womanizers Strike had encountered, Duffield's voice and mannerisms were slightly camp. Perhaps such men became feminized by prolonged immersion in women's company, or perhaps it was a way of disarming their quarry. Duffield indicated with a flutter of the hand that the others should move along the bench to make room for Kiara. The brunette looked crestfallen. Strike was left to find himself a low stool, drag it alongside the table, and ask Kiara what she wanted to drink.
"Ooh, get me a boozy oozy," she said. "And use my money, sweetie."
Her cocktail smelled strongly of Pernod. Strike bought himself water and returned to the table. Kiara and Duffield were now almost nose to nose, talking. But when Strike set down the drinks, Duffield looked around.
"So what'd you do, Cormoran? Music biz?"
"No," said Strike. "I'm a detective."
"No shit," said Duffield. "Who am I supposed to have killed this time?"
The group around him permitted themselves wry or nervous smiles, but Kiara said,
"Don't joke, Evan." "I'm not joking, Kiara. You'll notice when I am, because it'll be fucking funny."
The brunette giggled.
"I said I'm not joking," snapped Duffield.
The brunette looked as though she had been slapped. The rest of the group seemed imperceptibly to withdraw, even in the cramped space. They began their own conversation, temporarily excluding Kiara, Strike, and Duffield.
"Evan, not nice," said Kiara.
But her reproach seemed to caress rather than sting, and Strike noticed that the glance she threw the brunette held no pity. Duffield drummed his fingers on the edge of the table.
"So, what kind of a detective are you, Cormoran?"
"A private one."
"Evan, darling, Cormoran's been hired by Luli's brother."
But Duffield had apparently spotted someone or something of interest up at the bar, for he leapt to his feet and disappeared into the crowd there. "He's always a bit ADHD," said Kiara apologetically. "Plus, he's still really, really fucked up about Luli."
"He is,"
she insisted, half cross, half amused, as Strike raised his eyebrows and looked pointedly in the direction of the voluptuous brunette, who was now cradling an empty mojito glass and looking morose. "You've got something on your smart jacket," Kiara added, and she leaned forwards to brush off what Strike thought were pizza crumbs. He caught a strong whiff of her sweet, spicy perfume. The silver material of her dress was so stiff that it gaped, like armour, away from her body, affording him an unhampered view of small white breasts and pointed shell-pink nipples.
"What's that perfume you're wearing?"
She thrust a wrist under his nose.
"It's Guy's new one," she said. "It's called Éprise. It's French for smitten, you know?"
"Yeah," he said. Duffield had returned, holding another drink, cleaving his way back through the crowd, whose faces revolved after him, tugged by his aura. His legs in their tight jeans were like black pipe cleaners, and with his darkly smudged eyes, he looked like a Piero gone bad.
"Evan, babes," said Kiara, when Duffield had reseated himself, "Cormoran's investigating.
He heard you the first time. Strike interrupted her. There's no need.
He thought that the actor had heard that too. Duffield drank his drink quickly and tossed a few comments into the group beside them. Kiara sipped her cocktail, then nudged Duffield.
How's the film going, sweetie?
Great. Well, suicidal drug dealer. It's not a stretch, you know?
Everyone smiled, except Duffield himself. He drummed his fingers on the table, his legs jerking in time.
Bored now, he announced.
He was squinting towards the door, and the group was watching him, openly yearning, Strike thought, to be scooped up and taken along. Duffield looked from Kiara to Strike.
Want to come back to mine?
Fabby!
Squeaked Kiara. And with a feline glance of triumph at the brunette, she downed her drink in one. Just outside the VIP area, two drunk girls ran at Duffield. One of them pulled up her top and begged him to sign her breasts.
Don't be dirty, love, said Duffield, pushing past her. You got a car, Kiki?
He yelled over his shoulder, as he ploughed his way through the crowds, ignoring shouts and pointing fingers.
Yes, sweetie, she shouted. I'll call him. Cormoran, darling, have you got my phone?
Strike wondered what the paparazzi outside would make of Kiara and Duffield leaving the club together. She was shouting into her iPhone. They reached the entrance. Kiara said,
Wait, he's going to text when he's right outside.
Both she and Duffield looked slightly nervy, watchful, self-aware, like competitors waiting to enter a stadium. Then Kiara's phone gave a little buzz.
Okay, he's there, she said.
Strike stood back to let her and Duffield out first, then walked rapidly to the front passenger seat as Duffield ran around the back of the car in the blinding popping lights, to screams from the queue, and threw himself into the back seat with Kiara, who Colovis Jones had helped inside. Strike slammed the front passenger door, forcing the two men who had leaned in to take shot after shot of Duffield and Kiara to jump backwards out of the way. Colovis Jones seemed to take an unconscionable amount of time to return to the car. Strike felt as though the Mercedes interior was a test tube, simultaneously enclosed and exposed, as more and more flashes fired. Lenses were pressed to the windows and windscreen. Unfriendly faces floated in the darkness, and black figures darted back and forth in front of the stationary car. Beyond the explosions of light, the shadowy crowd queue surged, curious and excited.
Put your foot down for fuck's sake, Strike growled at Colovis Jones, who revved the engine.
The paparazzi blocking the road moved backwards, still taking pictures.
Bye-bye, you cunts,
said Evan Duffield from the back seat as the car pulled away from the curb. But the photographers ran alongside the vehicle, flashes erupting on either side, and Strike's whole body was bathed in sweat. He was suddenly back on a yellow dirt road in the juddering Viking, with a sound like firecrackers popping in the Afghanistan air. He had glimpsed a youth running away from the road ahead, dragging a small boy. Without conscious thought, he had bellowed, "Break!" lunged forwards and seized Anstis, a new father of 2 days standing, who was sitting right behind the driver. The last thing he remembered was Anstis's shouted protest and the low metallic boom of him hitting the back doors, before the Viking disintegrated with an ear-splitting bang and the world became a hazy blur of pain and terror. The Mercedes had rounded the corner onto an almost deserted road. Strike realized that he had been holding himself so tensely that his remaining calf muscles were sore. In the wing mirror, he could see two motorbikes, each being ridden pillion, following them. Princess Diana and the Parisian underpass. The ambulance bearing Lula Landry's body, with cameras held high to the darkened glass as it passed. Both careered through his thoughts as the car sped through the dark streets. Duffield lit a cigarette. Out of the corner of his eye, Strike saw Colovis Jones scowl at his passenger in the rearview mirror, though he made no protest. After a moment or two, Kiara began whispering to Duffield. Strike thought he heard his own name. 5 minutes later, they turned another corner and saw, ahead of them, another small crowd of black-clad photographers who began flashing and running towards the car the moment it appeared. The motorbikes were pulling up right behind them. Strike saw the four men running to catch the moment when the car doors opened. Adrenaline erupted. Strike imagined himself exploding out of the car, punching, sending expensive cameras crashing onto concrete as their holders crumpled. And as if he had read Strike's mind, Duffield said, with his hand poised on the door handle,
"Knock their fucking lights out, Cormoran, you're built for it."
The open doors, the night air, and more maddening flashes. Bull-like, Strike walked fast with his big head bowed, his eyes on Kiara's tottering heels, refusing to be blinded. Up three steps they ran, Strike at the rear, and it was he who slammed the front door of the building in the faces of the photographers. Strike felt himself momentarily allied with the other two by the experience of being hunted. The tiny, dimly lit lobby felt safe and friendly. The paparazzi were still yelling to each other on the other side of the door, and their terse shouts recalled soldiers wreckying a building. Duffield was fiddling at an inner door, trying a succession of keys in the lock.
"I've only been here a couple of weeks," he explained,
finally opening it with a barging shoulder. Once over the threshold, he wriggled out of his tight jacket, threw it onto the floor by the door, and then led the way, his narrow hips swinging in only slightly less exaggerated fashion than Guy Sommet's, down a short corridor into a sitting room, where he switched on lamps. The spare, elegant grey and black decor had been overlaid by clutter and stank of cigarette smoke, cannabis, and alcohol fumes. Strike was reminded vividly of his childhood.
"Need a slash," announced Duffield,
and called over his shoulder as he disappeared, with a directive jab of the thumb.
"Drinks are in the kitchen, Kiki."
She threw a smile at Strike, then left through the door Duffield had indicated. Strike glanced around the room, which looked as though it had been left by parents of impeccable taste in the care of a teenager. Every surface was covered in debris, much of it in the form of scribbled notes. Three guitars stood propped against the walls. A cluttered glass coffee table was surrounded by black-and-white seats, angled towards an enormous plasma TV. Bits of debris had overflowed from the coffee table onto the black fur rug below. Beyond the long windows, with their gauzy grey curtains, Strike could make out the shapes of the photographers still prowling beneath the streetlight. Duffield had returned, tugging up his fly. On finding himself alone with Strike, he gave a nervous giggle.
"Make yourself at home, big fella. Hey, I know your old man, actually."
"Yeah?" said Strike, sitting down in one of the squashy pony-skin cube-shaped armchairs.
"Yeah, met him a couple of times," said Duffield. "Cool dude."
He picked up a guitar, began to pick out a twiddling tune on it, thought better of it, and put the instrument back against the wall. Kiara returned, carrying a bottle of wine and three glasses.
"Couldn't you get a cleaner, dearie?"
she asked Duffield reprovingly.
"They give up," said Duffield.
He vaulted over the back of a chair and landed with his legs sprawled over the side.
"No fucking stamina."
Strike pushed aside the mess on the coffee table so that Kiara could set down the bottle and glasses.
"I thought you'd moved in with Mo Innes,"
she said, pouring out wine.
"Yeah, that didn't work out,"
said Duffield, raking through the detritus on the table for cigarettes.
"Old Freddy's rented me this place just for a month while I'm going out to Pinewood. He wants to keep me away from me old haunts."
His grubby fingers passed over a string of what seemed to be rosary beads. Numerous empty cigarette packets with bits of car torn out of them, three lighters, one of them an engraved Zippo, Rizzler papers, tangled leads unattached to appliances, a pack of cards, a sordid, stained handkerchief,
sundry crumpled pieces of grubby paper. A music magazine featuring a picture of Duffield in moody black and white on the cover. Opened and unopened mail. A pair of crumpled black leather gloves. A quantity of loose change and, in a clean china ashtray on the edge of the debris, a single cufflink in the form of a tiny silver gun. At last, he unearthed a soft packet of gitane from under the sofa, lit up, blew a long jet of smoke at the ceiling, then addressed Chiara, who had placed herself on the sofa at right angles to the two men, sipping her wine.
"They'll say we're fucking each other again, Key," he said, pointing out of the window at the prowling shadows of the waiting photographers.
"And what'll they say Cormoran's here for?" asked Chiara, with a sidelong glance at Strike. "A threesome?"
"Security," said Duffield, appraising Strike through narrowed eyes. "He looks like a boxer or a cage fighter. Don't you want a proper drink, Cormoran?"
"No, thanks," said Strike.
"What's that, AA or being on duty?"
"Duty."
Duffield raised his eyebrows and sniggered. He seemed nervous, shooting Strike darting looks, drumming his fingers on the glass table. When Chiara asked him whether he had visited Lady Bristow again, he seemed relieved to be offered a subject.
"Fuck no, once was enough. It was fucking horrible. Poor bitch, on her fucking deathbed."
"It was beyond nice of you to go, though, Evan." Strike knew that she was trying to show Duffield off in his best light.
"Do you know Lula's mother well?" he asked Duffield. "No. I only met her once before Lou died. She didn't approve of me. None of Lou's family approved of me. I don't know," he fidgeted. "I just wanted to talk to someone who really gives a shit that she's dead."
"Evan," Chiara pouted, "I care she's dead, excuse me."
"Yeah, well."
With one of his oddly feminine fluid movements, Duffield curled up in the chair so that he was almost fetal and sucked hard on his cigarette. On a table behind his head, illuminated by a cone of lamplight, was a large stagey photograph of him with Lula Landry, clearly taken from a fashion shoot. They were mock wrestling against a backdrop of fake trees. She was wearing a floor-length red dress, and he was in a slim black suit, with a hairy wolf's mask pushed up on top of his forehead.
"I wonder what my mum would say if I cocked it. My parents got an injunction out against me," Duffield informed Strike. "Well, it was mainly my fucking father, because I nicked their telly a couple of years ago. Do you know what?" he added, craning his neck to look at Chiara. "I've been clean 5 weeks, 2 days."
"That's so fabulous, baby. That's fantastic."
"Yeah,"
he said. He swiveled upright again.
"Aren't you going to ask me any questions?"
he demanded of Strike.
"I thought you were investigating Lou's murder."
The bravado was undermined by the tremor in his fingers. His knees began bouncing up and down, just like John Bristow's.
"Do you think it was murder?" Strike asked. "No."
Duffield dragged on his cigarette.
"Yeah, maybe, I don't know. Murder makes more sense than fucking suicide, anyway. Because she wouldn't have gone without leaving me a note. I keep waiting for a note to turn up, you know, and then I'll know it's real. It don't feel real. I can't even remember the funeral. I was out of my fucking head. I took so much stuff I couldn't fucking walk. I think if I could just remember the funeral, it'd be easier to get me head round."
He jammed his cigarette between his lips and began drumming with his fingers on the edge of the glass table. After a while, apparently discomforted by Strike's silent observation, he demanded,
"Ask me something, then. Who's hired you, anyway?"
"Lula's brother, John."
Duffield stopped drumming.
"That money-grabbing poker-ass wanker."
"Money-grabbing?"
"He was fucking obsessed with how she spent her fucking money. Like it was any of his fucking business. Rich people always think everyone else is a fucking freeloader. Have you noticed that? Her whole frigging family thought I was gold digging, and after a bit..."
He raised a finger to his temple and made a boring motion.
"It went in. It planted doubts, you know?"
He snatched one of the Zippos from the table and began flicking at it, trying to make it ignite. Strike watched tiny blue sparks erupt and die,
as Duffield talked.
"I expect he thought she'd be better off with some rich fucking accountant like him."
"He's a lawyer."
"Whatever. What's the difference? It's all about helping rich people keep their mitts on as much money as they can, isn't it? He's got his fucking trust fund from Daddy. What skin is it off his nose what his sister did with her own money?"
"What was it that he objected to her buying, specifically?"
"Shit for me. The whole fucking family was the same. They didn't mind if she chucked it their way, keep it in the fucking family, that was okay. Lou knew they were a mercenary load of fuckers, but like I say, it still left his fucking mark, planted ideas in her head."
He threw the dead Zippo back onto the table, drew his knees up to his chest, and glared at Strike with his disconcerting turquoise eyes.
"So he still thinks I did it, does he, your client?"
"No, I don't think he does," said Strike.
"He's changed his narrow, fuck-witted mind, then, because I heard he was going round telling everyone it was me before they ruled it as suicide. Only I've got a cast-iron fucking alibi, so fuck him. Fuck them. All."
Restless and nervous, he got to his feet, added wine to his almost untouched glass, then lit another cigarette. "What can you tell me about the day Lula died?" Strike asked.
"The night, you mean?"
"The day leading up to it might be quite important, too. There are a few things I'd like to clear up."
"Yeah? Go on, then."
Duffield dropped back down into the chair and pulled his knees up to his chest again. "Lula called you repeatedly between around midday and 6 in the evening, but you didn't answer your phone."
"No,"
said Duffield. He began picking childishly at a small hole in the knee of his jeans.
"Well, I was busy. I was working on a song. Didn't want to stem the flow, the old inspiration."
"So you didn't know she was calling you?"
"Well, yeah, I saw her number coming up."
He rubbed his nose, stretched his legs out onto the glass table, folded his arms and said,
"I felt like teaching her a little lesson. Let her wonder what I was up to."
"Why did you think she needed a lesson?"
"That fucking rapper. I wanted her to move in with me while he was staying in the building. Don't be silly, don't you trust me?"
His imitation of Lula's voice and expression was disingenuously girlish.
"I said to her, don't you be fucking silly. Show me I've got nothing to worry about and come and stay with me. But she wouldn't. So then I thought, two can play at that fucking game, darling. Let's see how you like it. So I got Ellie Carrera over to my place and we did a bit of writing together. And then I brought Ellie along to Uzi with me. Lou couldn't fucking complain. Just business, just songwriting, just friends. Like her and that rapper gangster."
"I didn't think she'd ever met D.B. Mack."
"She hadn't. But he'd made his intentions pretty fucking public, hadn't he? Have you heard that song he wrote? She was creaming her panties over it."
"Bitch, you ain't all that," Kiara began to quote obligingly, but a filthy look from Duffield silenced her. "Did she leave you voicemail messages?"
"Yeah, a couple. Evan, will you call me, please? It's urgent. I don't want to say it on the phone." It was always fucking urgent when she wanted to find out what I was up to. She knew I was pissed off. She was worried I might have called Ellie. She had a real hang-up about Ellie, because she knew we'd fucked.
"She said it was urgent, and that she didn't want to say it on the phone."
"Yeah, but that was just to try and make me cool. One of her little games. She could be fucking jealous, Lou, and pretty fucking manipulative."
"Can you think why she'd be calling her uncle repeatedly that day as well?"
"What uncle?"
"His name's Tony Landry. He's another lawyer."
"Him? She wouldn't be calling him. She fucking hated him worse than her brother."
"She called him repeatedly over the same period that she was calling you, leaving more or less the same message." Duffield raked his unshaven chin with dirty nails, staring at Strike.
"I don't know what that was about. Her mum, maybe. Old Lady B going into hospital or something."
"You don't think something might have happened that morning which she thought was either relevant to or of interest to both you and her uncle?"
"There isn't any subject that could interest me and her fucking uncle at the same time," said Duffield. "I've met him. Share prices and shit are all he'd be interested in."
"Maybe it was something about her, something personal."
If it was, she wouldn't call that fucker. They didn't like each other.
What makes you say that?
She felt about him like I feel about my fucking father. Neither of them thought we were worth shit.
Did she talk to you about that?
Oh, yeah. He thought her mental problems were just attention-seeking, bad behaviour, put on, burden on her mother. He got a bit smarmier when she started making money, but she didn't forget.
And she didn't tell you why she'd been calling you once she got to Uzi?
Nope,
said Duffield. He lit another cigarette.
She was fucked off from the moment she arrived because Ellie was there. Didn't like that at all. In a right fucking mood, wasn't she?
For the first time, he appealed to Kiara, who nodded sadly.
She didn't really talk to me, said Duffield. She was mostly talking to you, wasn't she?
Yes, said Kiara. And she didn't tell me there was anything, like, upsetting her or anything.
A couple of people have told me her phone was hacked, began Strike. Duffield talked over him.
Oh, yeah. They were listening in on our messages for fucking weeks. They knew everywhere we were meeting and everything. Fucking bastards. We changed our phone numbers when we found out what was going on, and we were fucking careful what messages we left after that.
So you wouldn't be surprised if Lula had something important or upsetting to tell you that she didn't want to be explicit over the phone?
Yeah, but if it was that fucking important, she would have told me at the club.
But she didn't.
No, like I say, she never spoke to me all night.
A muscle was jumping in Duffield's chiselled jaw.
She kept checking the time on her fucking phone. I knew what she was doing, trying to wind me up. Showing me she couldn't wait to get home and meet fucking D.B. Mack. She waited until Ellie went off to the bog, then got up, came over to tell me she was leaving, and said I could have my bangle back. The one I gave her when we had our commitment ceremony. She chucked it down on a table in front of me, with everyone fucking gawping. So I picked it up and said, "Anyone fancy this? It's going spare." And she fucked off.
He did not speak as though Lula had died 3 months previously, but as though it had all happened the day before, and there was still a possibility of reconciliation.
"You tried to restrain her, though, right?" asked Strike.
Duffield's eyes narrowed.
"Restrain her?"
"You grabbed her arms, according to witnesses."
"Did I? I can't remember."
"But she pulled free, and you stayed behind, is that right?"
"I waited 10 minutes, because I wasn't going to give her the satisfaction of chasing her in front of all those people, and then I left the club and got my driver to take me to Kentigern Gardens."
"Wearing the wolf mask," said Strike.
"Yeah, to stop those fucking scumbags."
He nodded towards the window,
"selling pictures of me looking wasted or pissed off. They hate it when you cover your face, depriving them of making their fucking parasitic living. One of them tried to pull Wolfie off me, but I held on. I got in the car and gave him a few pictures of the wolf giving him the finger out the back window. Got to the corner of Kentigern Gardens, and there were more paps everywhere. I knew she must have got in already."
"Did you know the key code?"
1966, yeah. But I knew she'd have told security not to let me up. I wasn't going to walk in front of all of them and then get chucked out on me arse 5 minutes later. I tried to phone her from the car, but she wouldn't pick up. I thought she'd probably gone downstairs to welcome D.B. fucking Mack to London. So I went off to see a man about pain relief."
He ground out his cigarette on a loose playing card on the edge of the table and began hunting for more tobacco. Strike, who wanted to oil the flow of conversation, offered him one of his own.
"Oh, cheers. Cheers, yeah. Well, I got the driver to drop me off and I went to visit my friend, who has since given the police a full statement to that effect, as Uncle Tony might say. Then I wandered around a bit, and there's camera footage in that station to prove that, and then about, I don't know, 3-ish, 4-ish.
4:30, said Kiara.
"Yeah, I went to crash at Kiara's."
Duffield sucked on the cigarette, watching the tip burn, then exhaling said cheerfully,
"So my arse is covered, is it not?"
Strike did not find his satisfaction likeable.
"And when did you find out that Lula was dead?"
Duffield drew his legs up to his chest again.
Kiara woke me up and told me. I couldn't. I was fucking... Yeah, well...